Hi, welcome to part two of True Stories of Tinseltown and my discussion with Victoria Riskin, who is a daughter of Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, and it's a goodie when I put it into two parts, so I hope you enjoy part two. We could have gone on forever. Thanks so much. Here it comes. That's pretty horrible.
It's a rather desperate moment.
Yeah. So she leaves Summerstock. How does she finally get Susan back?
Well, he ends up in New York, and he has a brother there, and the brother is a doctor, and he calls my mother. And she goes to New York, and there's a nurse that John has hired, both to look after him at this point and my sister. And he's very contrite, and she has no money at all. Can't even pay the nurse, much less the hotel bill. And she gets a call from her agent. You have to come back and work for 2 weeks. You'll get some money this way. And she goes back to Hollywood on the train to work for 2 weeks. And he takes off again with my sister. And now my mother's desperate. And she hires, she goes to the district attorney in Los Angeles, and she hires a lawyer whose name is Wild Bill Donovan. He ends up being the man who formed the Office of Strategic Services that became the CIA. He's a very strong, tough guy. And John had made a pit stop at the home of a famous journalist of the era, Claire, what's her name? Adla Rogers St. John. Uh-huh. And when he left, Adla called my mother and said, John's heading for Charlottesville, Virginia, where he has family. He was just falling apart.
Lost.
And my poor little sister is being dragged along. And he checked himself into a hospital. He knew he was in terrible trouble. And he checked in my sister. And my mother learned about where he was and went there with her lawyer and with Adla Rogers St. John. And the lawyer was able to convince John to release Susan into the care of my mother for, he said, just a couple of weeks. And as soon as John said yes, they left and went back to California, and finally my mother got sole custody. John heads down to Florida, and he is penniless, and a nice woman takes him in as a boarder, mm-hmm. and brings him his daily medicine, which was his alcohol.
Gosh.
And he unburdens his heart to this woman and says the only person he ever loved is Fay. And he was happy with her, and he's ruined his life. He knows it. And then he hung himself. And, you know, it's enough for a story unto itself.
Yeah, just that marriage alone and what was going on there. And it's fascinating. And you guys, just like I said, this book, things you've never known. And it's such an interesting life. So Faye's there. She is finally divorced from John. In the meantime, your dad is writing films. He's dating.
Right.
The woman that he moved there with wants to be married. He doesn't. So they split. And he starts dating Glenda Farrell, who I adore. I love her.
I'm so glad to hear you say
yes.
that. I fell in love with her writing this book because I'd seen her on film. I'd seen her in their film that they did together, which was A Lady for a Day.
Yes.
Which is where they met. She's marvelous in it.
She is so great.
Fantastic.
The whole cast.
But what I learned in researching Glenda, and I can see why he really loved being with her, is that she was an incredibly generous, kind, compassionate person, a wonderful friend, very bright, well-trained actress. And she had a son from a previous marriage. And so I think my father took an interest in this young man. And they dated for a couple of years.
That was so, and he gave her the two Siamese cats. And you know, I have to tell you, the picture you put in of the book of Glenda holding one of the Siamese cats, he has glasses on. Glenda got her cat glasses because that was the one that kept bumping into things. Yes, yes, yes. I'll send it to you. I'll send you the article and I'll send you the picture. But that's the picture. I posted that because I love Glenda.
Oh, you did? Okay. And, that's so funny.
Yes, and he's wearing glasses. So Glenda got her cat glasses. Now, does that tell you she's a doll or is she a doll?
Wonderful person. And while they're dating, see, this is where those stories weave. While they're dating, my mother and Glenda are making Mystery of the Wax Museum together. So I just love those little cross currents.
I wonder if they saw each other on that, if they had anything, if they met each other. Yeah, that was a good one. Did your mother like Glenda?
Very much.
Yeah, she just seems so down to earth.
And they play roommates, you know, and best friends. So, So it was that part's funny. Yeah. So, but you know, again, he shied away from marriage, and they had a wonderful time together. They went to New York. They went to theater. He hunted down these twin Siamese cats. Right? Is that you know, the humor of that alone? They go to nightclubs together. They go to picnics on the weekend, and I think for him, she had a lovely apartment, you know, coming home and just having a dinner at her place was marvelous for him. And but he also wanted his time to be alone and to write and to see his other good friends, the couples who often recruited him to come to dinner. They liked having him around. He was wonderful company, funny and smart. So... yeah.
They ended. And did he start? Then he started dating Carol Lombard, another woman I love.
Yes.
He wrote Virtue, right?
They had first met on the set of Virtue. And
love that movie.
And she insisted that the Harry Cohen make sure that the writer was on the set every day. So, but at that time, Carol was involved. Well, she was married. Well, she was married to William Powell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she was madly in love with a singer.
Russ Colombo? Was that
Russ
his name?
Russ Colombo, yeah. And, my father and Carol they loved hanging out. And sometimes they would hang out at the Trocadero and there were other people, you know, it was like a gang of people.
So it wasn't this big love thing.
It was not a big love thing. Although I'm quite sure he was captured by her, interested in her, but he was seeing Glenda Farrell and she was involved with Powell and then Russ Colombo. And then Russ Colombo is killed in an accident in his home.
A dueling pistol, like these antique dueling pistols. His friend was there with him, and allegedly.
And people say who know, I mean, I don't know if it's true, but that Colombo was the great love of her life. And he was a wonderful singer and a handsome guy. And I suspect, although I fairly soon after that, she and my father spend lots and lots of time together, and I am sure he was a great comfort to her.
Yeah.
And initially, that it was about his caring for a friend, and then the friendship turned into a more serious romance that lasted for about a year. And there was a lot of talk. You know, it's hard to know. So there was so much that I read in the papers of the time, Variety and Reporter, about that their romance and the anticipation of marriage. And suddenly, when she's wearing a big ring, you know, that it came from my father. And maybe all that is true. I think they got close. My uncle told me that she proposed to my father. And again, he just couldn't say yes. Mm-hmm. and so that broke it off. and she was not happy about that, and soon after met Clark Gable. But my father had a picture of Carol on his bookshelf. You know, 2 years later, after they stopped dating, she was still a figure in his appreciation. He was fond of her, and that never changed.
Yeah, well, that's everything I've heard about her. Well, he had good taste in women, if I have to say. Glenda Farrell, who I think was great, and Carol Lombard, who people loved. She was beloved by most of Hollywood, if not all. And so he was then free. Did he have another serious woman in his life before your mom?
Not really. There were women that he dated. You know, he was seen a lot with Loretta Young.
Oh, yes.
He was, and they were friends, so to speak. Mm-hmm. A little more than friends, probably.
Yeah.
And there were other women. One who was crazy about him, but he was. After, I think, Carol Lombard, he just felt, I don't want to get into a situation where I let someone down. And so he was just careful. But he loved being with women. He thought women were the best sort of, he adored women. And in a lovely way.
As where friends, he actually could see a woman as a friend, not just as
body,
you know.
Totally. He just thought they were
mind.
Fun
yeah.
and bright and sparkly
yeah.
So he enjoyed the company of women. He liked dancing. He liked being out on the town, and then sometimes he would just want to be by himself or with good friends. And but I think he was a very sensitive man, and I don't think he wanted to get into a situation again where he would let a woman down. You know, that was very hard for him.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, to disappoint.
But before they even got together, did they? They got your mother and your father met, but she was going out. She was with Clifford Odette, the playwright.
Right.
But they got they kind of liked each other, but she went back to Clifford Odette.
Well, that was kind of interesting. So after John Monk Saunders, she was doing summer stock again, and she met Clifford Odets, and he was, at that time, probably the most important playwright in the country. He had 3 plays on Broadway in 1 year. And his plays were so much about the political landscape of the time and the rights of workers and thinking about America during the Depression and the union movement and so on. And so he was just revered, and he was the important person at the Group Theater in New York, which was the cutting edge group of actors and directors and writers. So she spent a couple of years with Clifford Odets, and in that time he was in New York and she came to Los Angeles. And my father's best friend was Joe Swirling, and his wife Flo was one of those people who is a born matchmaker.
Mm-hmm.
She wants people to be happy, and it's her personal agenda, and she's going to make it happen. And she felt my father and my mother, who she knew, should be together. Now, neither one of them had yet come anywhere near that conclusion, But around this time, my father and mother are both invited to a party at the home of Richard Barthelmess and
mm-hmm.
his wife. And all the people who are invited are single. And my mother was in a very good mood, and she was standing by the piano and singing a little, dancing a little, you know, just kind of by herself almost, enjoying the very festive Christmas atmosphere. And my father watched her, and he was totally captivated, and he went over and asked her if she would like to go see a movie. They go to see The Grapes of Wrath, which is not a comedy.
No, it's very dark and depressing.
Very dark.
About the Dust Bowl.
Story.
Yeah.
And she was so moved by it because of the suffering. And he watched, you know, he could see she was such a tender spirit. And so he asked her out again, and over the course of the next couple of, few weeks while she's there, and they go out for dinner, and he doesn't make a move on her or anything at first. He just begins to tell her about himself. He opens up for the first time. He feels completely safe with her. She didn't understand what a big thing that was for him. She just felt he was a lovely human being, and she enjoyed his company. And then she senses that he is becoming more attached to her, and she has to go back to New York and to Clifford Odets, and she has to tell him about this relationship. And meanwhile, the matchmaker is telling my father that Faye is perfect, and telling Faye that my father's perfect, you know. But anyway, she tells him that she has this relationship with Clifford Odets, and she's going to go back to New York to be with him. And my father was crushed. And I think for the first time, probably really found the person he wanted to be with.
Who actually said no. And she was like, sorry, I can't.
Yeah, so she goes, he's crushed. She goes back to New York to be with Clifford. And she expects that she and Clifford are going to get married and live in the country, and he'll write great plays, and Susan will be with him. But it's clear to Clifford after a while that he's not able to get married. And part of it is that he was a turbulent, damaged soul.
Yes.
And the way he put it later was he felt that she was a wonderful human being and that he would make her unhappy. And that's probably true.
He probably
was right about that.
Yeah, he probably thought, you know how women like bad boys, and he probably needed someone who could, I don't know, not corrupt. He couldn't corrupt, really, because they had their own demons, too. And maybe your mom was just too good for that, as far as that goes.
Yeah, I think he had demons. His father was a very abusive father,
yeah.
And he had taken in a very dark view of himself. I had a wonderful couple of long conversations with Clifford Odets' son in writing the book. And first of all, I felt I'd found a brother an additional brother. He's just a great guy. And he knew his father well, and he knew Faye, and he said on his deathbed that Clifford said that my mother was the only woman he really loved. Now, that may or may not be true, but that was kind of a tragic comment, that he was afraid of the happiness she might bring
him, yeah.
And that he would cause her unhappiness. And I think that's all correct.
I think he would have. But
yeah,
knowing your mother, she's mm-hmm. the stick to it, and I'm going to help my mankind guy. But thank goodness
mm-hmm.
he didn't do that. So
hence, right, that was a gift.
Yeah.
He gave her a gift.
Mm-hmm. She goes back to Hollywood, and?
Well, then my father leaves for, my father makes a picture called Meet John Doe.
Love right? it.
We all know, yeah. And at the end of making that film, and that's an interesting film to talk about because of all the challenges and what it was trying to say, but he and Capra had set up their own company, and they made Meet John Doe. They were going to make another Meet John Doe, a sequel, but my father decided that it was time for him to go to Europe, and that's because the United States did not want to get into the war. There were many people who were against helping the British. They didn't like the British. They thought the British had gotten them into trouble with World War One. And my father now had spent time in England, and he loved the English, and he knew what was going on. He traveled to Europe. He'd seen the rise of Hitler up fairly close on, and he he is very moved by the broadcasts of Edward R. Murrow describing the suffering of what's happening to London. It's being pounded by the Germans, and you know, the thought that Hitler would dominate the world was frightening. So he leaves. My father leaves for Europe to volunteer his services for the Ministry of Information of the British government and to figure out what he can do to help persuade Americans, the public, to care about what was happening in England. So he goes to England, he goes to Coventry, he sees the bombed out cities, and he did some broadcasts for CBS. While Edward R. Murrow was actually, I think, in New York, and I was able to find a copy of one of those broadcasts.
That's great.
But what he's saying to the public is, America, these Brits are really ordinary people like you and me, and they're courageous, and they're shopkeepers during the day, but at night they get out and they do their jobs, and you know, and he describes what he sees. He's trying to say, paint with pictures, words, pictures of what's happening to these towns, and to the people, and their heroism, and their wish to free the world of Hitler, and so that was. That's what he's doing. Now comes, Pearl Harbor. And 3 days later, most Americans forget this part, but Hitler declared war on America. So there's no question about America getting into the war. And he comes straight back to New York. And when he gets to New York, Flo and Joe Swirling, his best friends, are there. And Flo says to him, Faye is no longer with Clifford Odets, and I've spoken to her, and she would love to see you. And he says, are you sure? And they say, yes, she's waiting for your call. And he calls her and goes over to her apartment, and that was the beginning of everything.
So he basically never left.
And he never left, yep.
And he also adopted your sister Susan. Mm-hmm. He loved her. He loved your mom. And, mm-hmm. you know, I just thought your mother was pretty great because she was not this clingy, I'm going to hold on to you and not let you be who you are or do what you have to do. She quit mm-hmm. her career when they got married. Mm-hmm. But she was not, you know what I mean? Other women like your dad, he got involved with the war and going over to England quite a bit and going to other places. So he was gone a lot. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, the beautiful love letters he wrote her and she, him. I mean, it was just, I admired her for being not, I don't know, knowing that we're individuals along with mm-hmm. being married. She knew that he had to be that kind of guy as well.
Yeah, I think she had so much love and respect for him, and he was on a big mission then for the War Department to make
movies. They made documentaries, right?
He made documentaries. He set up a whole division of the War Department under the Office of War Information. He made these movies to tell the story of America to people who had been living under fascism. He made 26 documentaries. He had to go over and distribute them. They were wonderful little films. And she was just thrilled to see what he was doing and proud of him. And it was hard for them to be apart because at one point they were apart for 6 months.
Yikes. When did she get pregnant with your bro, your big brother?
My brother.
Yeah.
Well, see, he was born July 1943.
Oh, so that was pretty much.
You have to back that up.
Yeah. he was just a twinkle in their eye at that point.
He was
a
9 months before that.
Yeah.
This is what I figure.
Yeah. But was he overseas at the time before coming back and forth? When did he start going and doing that for the War Department, showing the documentaries and doing that?
Well, first, let's see. by the time they got married in 1942 in August, and he was already setting up this division, and it was a major, film production unit, and he was thrilled to have it. So I think he started setting that up in June 1942, and then within I think it was about a year later that after my brother was born in July, and by October. He was going to Europe. He thought he would be gone for 6 months, 6 weeks. I'm sorry.
Oh wow!
But he was gone for 6 months because once they had these films, then he followed he and his trucks of they had truckloads of movies because it wasn't just the, it was the documentaries that they did which told the story of America in these wonderful imaginative ways, but also he took feature films from Hollywood, and they put them on trucks and went into the villages. As Eisenhower was liberating North Africa, he was these guys were right behind, and they would secure an area and open up theaters and invite thousands of people would come and see these movies. And it was a way of restoring a sense of friendship with America. It was just brilliant. And but so many of the theaters, like in Italy, had been shut down. There wasn't enough electricity. Maybe they'd been bombed, and they went. This crew went all the way up through Sicily and Italy and into France and Belgium. And by the time of D-Day, the troops landed. My father was in Europe. One of his letters, you could tell he knew about D-Day. He had security clearance, but he knew there was going to be an invasion, and that it was going to be enormous, and that it was going to be the push to win the war. And they came in right after it was secure, within days, with these movies. And turned on lights in theaters and got people to come back and have a moment of entertainment.
Which seemed unthinkable, you know, far past. So I think that, yeah. You know, I think that was a really great thing your dad did. And he created the whole thing. And your mom had tons of reasons to be proud of him. You want to know, this is something I find fascinating because I always go on IMDb and then because I want to see what movies your father did. And I get the list of your mothers. And then they give you little things. And it says your mother is a lifelong Republican, who voted for Dewey. Mm-hmm. Like, she wasn't, was she?
No, that's totally wrong.
I know, because I'm reading this. She wanted Roosevelt to win, and she was waiting. He was there. She was waiting overnight, and she wanted it to be a landslide. And,
right.
Yeah. So I'm reading this, and she's best friends with, John Wayne and all these people.
If you could do something to correct that, I would be really grateful.
I will, because
I have nothing against Republicans generally, but she never was.
Yeah, so that to me was...
Especially, she adored FDR, and she was out campaigning for him, giving speeches before huge audiences.
Yeah, so I looked at that today after I had read, and I'm like, my God, what are they talking about? So it makes you wonder, anything else they write about people that... They can get that.
I learned
so
in doing
wrong.
This book that I would read something and then I would double check it.
Yes.
And that is true about, the Capra Riskin relationship was quite different than the way some people have characterized it, including Capra himself. Not so much in terms of them having a good working relationship because they did, but who did what and where ideas came from. And the notion that Capra was a writer could not be more false, and yet it prevails today.
Well, that's because Frank Capra told people that.
That's the way he made it sound, right?
That was him, you know, Capra-esque. Lost Horizon, your father wrote, right? Mm-hmm. My God, so many movies.
Yes, and it was his idea. I'll just go on the record here. He had read the book when he was in England on a trip, and it was a very popular book in England. No one wanted to make it in America. First of all, if you read the book, you can't even imagine it would ever be a movie because it's a little philosophical, kind of soft story.
Right.
And But he came back from Europe with a book, and he convinced Capra to do it. And they went to Harry Cohn and proposed it. And at that point, Capra and Riskin were so important to Columbia and Harry Cohn that if they wanted to do, anything they wanted to do, Cohn would basically support it because he could see the results. But they had they proposed Lost Horizon before they made Deeds, mm-hmm. but they wanted Ronald Colman, and they decided to wait, and they went ahead and did Mr. Deeds first.
Yeah, your father even has had a dog named Deeds. He got a Deeds dog.
He had a dog named Deeds.
That's a great movie as well.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film.
And Ronald Colman was perfect for that part, so it was was perfect that they waited for him. I couldn't imagine anyone else in that role for Lost Horizon.
No, and I think Capra was fantastic at casting. For the most part, he had good instincts and was great with actors for the most part. Mm-hmm. Not everybody had good experiences with him, i.e. Claudette Colbert initially didn't want to do It Happened One Night for many reasons, but one of which is that she had a terrible experience with Capra. But I think when Capra and my father started to work together, there was an electricity and a fun and a sweetness, and they
oil and vinegar made a wonderful salad dressing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Very well said.
Thank
Very
you.
Well said.
Thank you. But so I digressed. I was just saying some more of the movies. You guys, wait to read this book. I mean, amazing. So your dad's in England. The war ends, and he comes home.
Right.
And then you're a twinkle
well,
in the
born.
Eye,
I
and
mean,
you're
that's
born.
The only important thing that happens.
That's what I was just going to say. The twinkle in the eye finally becomes you. It's you. So
yeah.
You're
I'm the caboose, but I'm a happy caboose.
Yes. So you get there, and your dad wants to do his own films. Is that correct? When mm-hmm. he comes back, yeah.
Yeah. So when he comes back. I think when a bunch of these guys came back, they didn't want to get stuck in the studio system again. So people were setting up independent companies, and there was even an association of independent company owners that was put together. They had given of themselves to their country, and they've been entrepreneurial in those efforts. And so he sets up Robert Riskin Productions, and gets kind of an office and a landing pad at Paramount. And Capra set up a company with William Wyler and George Stevens, and they're trying to be an independent.
They were Liberty,
company.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
They were Liberty. Yeah, and my dad hires a couple of people, and then they have a little business going. So,
he does two movies.
He does two movies. He did one called Magic Town.
Yes,
with Jimmy Stewart and Jane Wyman, which is actually quite a delightful film. And then he has another one that he's got underway. But it was extremely tough. They did distribute Magic Town, but the landscape, there were lots of things going on at that time. First of all, there was, in 1947, it was the Hollywood 10. So the headlines everywhere about Hollywood are not about the movies that are being made, but about people who are communists.
Yeah. Well, it started that early. I didn't know it was that early.
It actually started even before the war, but now comes the Hollywood 10, and those people who are willing to go to prison to avoid,
naming names.
Naming names. And also based on their First Amendment rights, the free speech.
Of course, that you
blah,
can
blah,
say.
Blah.
So it was unbelievable. Also, Clifford Odets. I didn't know he was one of the ones who mm-hmm. sold his friends out. I knew Elia Kazan did it. But I didn't know he did it as well. I was pretty, that was something new to me.
There was quite a bit of that going on. And so Magic Town comes out right in the middle of that. Plus, it was just, with that going on, people weren't going to movies so much. And also maybe the kind of movies that they want to see are more, not so much romantic comedies in that post-war era where the country was trying to get back on its feet, the economy wasn't good. So after maybe a year and a half, my father closed up his company, and the same thing for Capra. He does It's a Wonderful Life. That didn't do well financially, and Liberty Films shuts down, and they all go back to working as employees at studios. So that was sort of the tale of the hoped for independent movement, which was very exciting for a bit. But
your father, the Writers Guild, all that stuff, what did they think that union, if you were in a union or you were a Democrat, it equaled communist? I don't know, because it seemed like it was such a broad swath of people who they were, blacklisting.
The real, by 1947, the union had made a deal with the studios, and some of that name calling was over. But there were people who had been communists, right? They were the people in the 1930s who joined the Communist Party because people were starving in the country.
Yes.
25% of the workforce was unemployed. There were bread lines. And it seemed as though this kind of idealistic, everybody has a guaranteed job, everyone has a guaranteed apartment, the communism ideal was an answer. Of course, no one quite understood until much later that Stalin was a horrible person.
Yeah, but, and communism in theory sounds lovely, that we'll all be equal, but
right.
it never works
right.
that way. There's always the person who is the big cheese, who lives in these grand houses and his grand house friends, and other people, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, but of course the idea of communism was very threatening to the business class in the country, and so there was huge pushback, and Hollywood was just a piece of that landscape, but because there were so many liberals in Hollywood,
yeah.
or supposed liberals, and there were those who saw Stalin as the bulwark against Hitler.
Well, they did propaganda films, too. They did a propaganda film that I watched. I can't remember the name. Walter Huston started, Anne Harding, and it just shows how, everybody has caviar, and everything was just lovely in Russia, and it was
right.
just
right.
very right. very much a propaganda
there were, and
film.
And those, the post-war years, in the pre-war years, there was this anti-communist, focus on Hollywood, but people didn't take it too seriously, but it really ramped up right after the war. It never went away. It was always part of the government and State Department, and then comes the serious business of the House Un-American Activities Committee, even before McCarthy. Several years before McCarthy takes over the House Un-American Activities Committee. So it was a difficult landscape in Hollywood, and my dad goes back to work.
But he was not accused at all. Your dad was never accused.
He was not accused. The only time someone challenged him on possibly being affiliated with the communist movement was when he was getting security clearance during the war.
Mm.
And the interrogator said, Mr. Riskin, aren't you affiliated or aren't you a member of a communist-leaning organization? And he said, what are you talking about? And they said, the Writers Guild of America, or Writers Guild then it was called. And my father said, that's outrageous. The hearing came to a quick end. But so this is during the war. Even during the war, it was a worry about and accusations of communist
and anarchists and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
They have a happy home life. Once he's home,
wonderful.
They yep. love mm-hmm. each other. They love their children. You love your parents. He's fun. I love the picture of your poor, dirty snowman. that you got that snow that one time, and you guys got out there, and your dad was helping you make your snowman, and you were wondering where your mom was, but your mom was there mm-hmm. taking pictures mm-hmm. of the snowman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seemed like you had such a lovely life, and he sounded like such a nice guy, and your mother just, you know, just sweet. And I love how she called you darling. And my mother used mm-hmm. to call me darling all the time, too. And I love that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They just seem like such a nice couple and so sweet. Mm-hmm. And then, boom.
Yeah.
Comes the big kibosh, boom, for.
It was a beautiful life, beautiful house, lots of fun. Everybody wanting the kids to have a good time. Lots of parties and magic shows and playfulness.
Tager.
And except for our next door neighbor.
Tager. Why did they make you get married to him when you were four? I was appalled.
I think his grandfather who was raising him, his grandfather was Billy Wilder's writing partner, Charles Brackett. Did tons of fantastic movies. And he was raising his grandson. And I think Charlie Brackett liked me. He thought I was a cute little girl. And wouldn't it be cute if there was a kind of pretend wedding?
Oh, my God. Why didn't they just take two
dogs
to get married?
I was terrified of Tigger, and I didn't understand that it wasn't real. I thought it was about to be, you know, sold like a child into trafficking.
Chattel, there she goes.
But
Tigger's
But you can
wife.
Tell I survived. But it was, by and large, a beautiful
ceremony.
5 years.
Oh,
of,
you did.
Of
bliss with
early,
your parents.
And with my parents. And then my father had a terrible stroke, and he never recovered. And that was just devastating to everybody. My mother was heroic. She kept the house going. She was with him at the hospital every day. She wrote down everything he said when he could speak or tried to speak from the stroke. She arranged for him ultimately to go to the Motion Picture Country Home, which is a care facility set up by the motion picture industry.
Yeah, because you guys didn't have insurance at that time.
There was no insurance. There was no Medicare. There was no pension plan. There was nothing. So she just had to write checks out of her pocketbook until there wasn't very much left. And we moved to a smaller house. My father's in the care, in the convalescent care, and she goes back to work. And as I was writing this book, Grace, you can imagine how heroic she seemed to me. I mean, as a child, I just thought of her as my wonderful mother who made my peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know. But knowing that she had three children and had to go back to work,
adored her husband, who is now never going to be the same, and watching, seeing him like that is not an easy thing, but she loved him, and she was there for him every day, as well as for you guys. She was heroic.
She was there for all of us, and, you know, I was very, we were all very sad. It was a household that was then kind of turned sad because we so missed him. And everything that was going on, and she would try to keep us cheered up, and you know, it was not easy.
No. And how long? So you were five when your father had the stroke,
right? And he died when I was 10. He finally succumbed.
Oh my goodness!
He was having more strokes.
It was 5 years he lasted through that? Yikes!
And I did a very clever thing, which was, as a child, you get to have your own imagination. So I had this notion that he was living in the south of France, and one day I'd be old enough and I could go find him. And even though I would see him in the convalescent home, I just kind of, that was one reality. And then my reality at night, when I was falling asleep, I would pretend that I could get on the train
to France.
Nobody traveled by plane then, but and get on a boat, and I would take this whole trip in my head, and then we would be reunited as he was when he was well. And I by the time I was 25, I went and told a therapist this and said, well, I know it's not true, but you know, there was still a part of me that thought, oh, I wish it were true.
Of course,
that dream would come true.
Because yeah. he was an amazing man, and you were blessed to have him as yeah. your dad. When I read everything about him, and like with your mom, your dad died, and your mom ended up remarrying. He was your father's doctor?
Yeah, so when I think what happened for my mother when my father was ill, and the doctor was so caring, mm-hmm. They became friends. She felt comforted by him, and
yes.
then, you know, that turned into something else. But and that was actually a good thing, because I was, again, this, you know, I reflect on this in writing the book. She had someone that was looking after her and helping her.
But as children, you had to have resented him a little bit.
No, I didn't like him at all.
He's sitting in my father's seat. Get him out of here. I would have felt that way. I mean, it's just a normal kid reaction. But yes, as an adult, you see, you were glad that your mother had someone, because she, you know, she needed somebody.
She needed somebody. Yeah. Yeah. But, and I think he helped her figure out how to save some money and then buy a building, you know, and she had real estate, and then she could work if she wanted to and didn't have to work if she didn't want to. And then ultimately they got married, and she created a new life. She lived several lives, I think.
I think so. Amazing. The whole, you guys will love this book. And I can't tell you, because I learned so much about Faye, whom I love. And like I said, I cannot watch King Kong, but I do love, I've seen other films. I like Ann Carver. I just hate the ending.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm with you on that. That's like a,
oh, geez.
But, and we have to forgive it because it was
of the time
era.
But it's a good one. I'm not going to spoil for you guys. So check that one out if it comes around on TCM.
And you know, the truth is, my mother, when I added up all of her credits, and I included, you know, some the television, and I included some of the early credits I was able to find. She starred in over 120 films.
Wow.
Or television
productions.
Shows. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And in one two-year period, 1933 through 1934, she starred in 21 films. So she had a very big and robust career beyond that big beast called King Kong.
Although he was cute, I have to say.
Yeah, well, he was at times.
Well, only if he was pushed. He was. He lived on Skull Island. They King Kong nap him. You know, what are you going to do anyway? So, but she was lovely, and the book is fabulous. So basically, she outlived the doctor.
Yes,
and she kept going. I remember seeing her at the Academy Awards. I remember seeing her. You escorted her, right? You were there with your mom.
I did. That was so much fun. I just was so happy to have her go there and you know,
get that recognition she deserved.
Yes, exactly.
I would have been thrilled. And you two were like BFFs. You got along great.
We did. We did. She was funny, and I liked to be funny back with her.
And you married a writer as well, and you were a psychotherapist, and now you are also a writer, and you were president of the Writers Guild for a while, so that totally ran your family. And you just wrote one really good book. I mean, I don't generally, a lot of times I skip through the childhood parts of people. Like, okay, let's get to getting to Hollywood. But I just loved it all. And like I said, I read it once, and then I knew you were coming on today, so I wanted to reread, and it was not a punishment. I enjoyed it. You know, sometimes you have to read something, it's like, oh my. Because I do read. I do read people who come on my show. I read their books. So I just think it's the best thing to do. So you're not, you know what you're talking about, and you're not just.
Well, my dream was not only to tell about these two people who are really wonderful to spend
incredible
time with, but to set the context too for their lives and what was going on in the
historically
country and in
the whole thing.
Yeah, not in a heavy-handed way.
Not at all. This is such a good read. And you, like I told her, I fell in love with her father. I mean, I wanted him. I thought, what a fun, what a smart, wonderful man. You know, he probably wouldn't have married me, but oh well, what are you going to do?
he didn't want to marry anybody.
But he married your mother.
My mother did propose to him, and he accepted, so that worked out well.
Well, didn't she propose to him, and he didn't accept, so then he finally proposed to her?
No, she proposed to him. She proposed to him, mm-hmm. and he took a little time to think about it, and then he sent her. They were in New York together, and he goes back to Los Angeles, and he sends her a telegram, and he says, "Can you get the name of that judge?" And she doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, this is like 2 weeks later, and she says, "What judge?" And then he telegrams back, "You know the judge. I mean, my goodness, don't be so, you know, silly, you goon." The judge to get married. So that was his way. He was always he never liked to say anything too directly. He always liked to have a kind of little play. So, can you find the name of that judge?
How cute. And they got married. And unfortunately, they didn't have a long marriage, but they had a very loving and, mm-hmm. I think, a beautiful love story. And Victoria, you wrote a really good book. And I cannot, like I said, I still haven't reread it the second time all the way through, and I'm going to. And the name of the book is Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir, and it was written by Victoria Riskin. And it is not heavy-handed. It is not, you know, she talks about whatever, you know, the communist stuff, whatever. It's just just to kind of show where people are in their lives and what's going on in the lifetime, what's going on in the country, what's going on in the world. It's not heavy-handed at all. It's a really good book, and things you never knew about Fay. I really liked her a lot in this book. Not that I ever disliked her, but I didn't know what I knew about her. And Robert Riskin, wait till you guys see the credits of everything he's written. It's amazing. So, Victoria, this has been such a pleasure for me. And this is going to be a couple of parter because we went 1 hour 47. So I'm going to make this a two-parter. But there's just too much to tell. You know, there's just too much to tell. We couldn't do it in 45 minutes. There's just too much. So thank you so much. And again, the book, Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir, and she tells about a life. There's some Joan Crawford stuff and other people, tons of, people popping up that we didn't talk about, but you're going to really like this book. It's a great Hollywood memoir, and it really, I loved your parents. That's all I can say.
Thank you so much. Well, Grace, you do a fabulous interview, and it's been wonderful to talk to you. And it's a free and breezy conversation.
Yeah, nice and easy. And no, you know, like I did, I do write notes, but I did not even look at them except to quote Jacob about marriage. But I didn't look at them otherwise. So that's what I usually do. I write notes.
That was a good springboard.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe that'll generate a little conversation. Does marriage spoil romance or not? And
I think
see what your listeners think.
50-50, 70-20, 30, who knows? You never know. It depends, doesn't it?
But who knows?
Divorce court. Anyway, so thank you so
much. I'm happily married, so I'm on that side.
I'm so happy for you, too. Yeah. He seems like a sweetie, and your mother loved him. And you are a darling. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great.
I really loved it. And I love the book. I love you. I love your parents. Hallelujah.
You okay. Take care. All right.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Victoria. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The club with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment. The plot can be hot, simply teeming with sex. A gay divorcee who is after her ex. It can be Oedipus Rex, where a chap kills his father and costs a lot of bother. The clerk who is thrown out of work by the boss, who is thrown for a loss by the skirt, who is doing him dirt. The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment. Like you see on the screen, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen. Some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet, and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan. Hip hooray, the American way. The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.